This morning on Focus, we will be continuing with a kind of informal series that we've been doing here, looking at international issues that are important issues in the presidential contest that we have going now here in the United States. This year, particularly because of economic issues, that's pretty much what's on people's minds. But we also want to say, well, that's not the only thing that we should be talking about. And certainly we should be talking about international issues as well. And this time around, we'll try to talk a little bit about policy, American policy, in regards to Africa and Latin America. Talk a little bit about what it has been, what it is now, and where some of the priorities should be. And we have two guests here with us, both from the University of Illinois, to help us have that conversation, Merle Bowen and Niels Jacobson. Merle Bowen is Associate Professor of Political Science, and she is particularly interested in Africa. Niels Jacobson is Associate Professor of History, and he's particularly interested in Latin America. And we're glad that the two of them could be here and spend a little time with us. The number, if you'd like to call in to ask a question, it's the same number that we always use, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. We'll pay for it. That's 800-222-9455. Either way, we'd be very happy to have people call in, ask questions, make comments. We just ask people to be brief so we can keep moving along, but anybody's welcome to call. Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you, David.
I think that there was a time when the expectation was that at least one international issue would be very big, and that's certainly still on people's minds, Iraq, Afghanistan, and so forth. But it seems that the economic concerns have just eclipsed everything in this election. So I think it's I think it's a good thing that we're at least trying to spend a little time talking about these kinds of things. And I think as far as Africa and Latin America goes, you have to think back to a time, well, as far as Latin America is concerned, in the Cold War, it was very high on the agenda, not so much anymore. And I think there are many people who would say Africa has never been very high on the agenda, and there are good reasons why we should be paying more attention to Africa. Let's start and talk just a little bit about current American policy in these two spheres. And why don't we start with Africa, and then we'll talk a little bit about Latin America.
Okay. Well, thank you for having us here. We appreciate this opportunity to talk about our different areas of interest. I guess I would like to just start by saying, as in terms of introductory remarks, that despite the end of the Cold War and the fall of apartheid, there is really no coherent African policy to replace the Cold War policies. There are pieces of a coherent policy. For example, the support for the war against AIDS is now a bipartisan issue, and both the presidential candidates have pledged to focus on Darfur. But just to give you an example, a case in point, it was only this year, before his 90th birthday, that the U.S. government finally took Mr. Nelson Mandela and members of his ANC party off the list of terrorists. Mm-hmm. And this was indeed a legacy of past support for official apartheid policy. If we look at the current administrator's policy, despite the fact that, President Bush has made multiple trips to Africa, there's been much rhetoric and some achievements, he still has not put together a new framework for building sustainable ties with Africa. And again, to give you a case in point, and I hope we'll get a chance to talk about this, but is Darfur. But I think the current U.S. national interest in Africa can be reduced to really three main features: anti-terrorism, Africa's oil, and competition with China. Well, one of the most important and controversial policies of the Bush administration in Africa today has to do with AFRICOM. And AFRICOM is a policy that President Bush announced in 2007. And basically he announced that the United States would create a new military command for Africa. And this new Africa command is often referred to as AFRICOM. So that this month, in fact, 2008, AFRICOM became very operational, fully operational. It's headquartered in Germany. And the reason it's not headquartered, it's not based in an African country, is because of the resistance, the opposition in terms of civil society and African governments to have this headquarters on the continent. So the U.S. government position in brief is the following. Africa is important to our security. Terrorism is a real threat to American and U.S. interests. And indeed, terrorists have struck African soil. Americans are very, concerned, American government, I should say, that these failed states in Africa can become incubators, if you want, for training extremists. And if you looked at the failed state index, 8 out of the top 10 countries at most at risk were in Africa, and the other two, of course, being Iraq and Afghanistan. So from the American perspective, U.S. government perspective, the objective for AFRICOM is really to work with partners to help them build up their security capacity by training armies and peacekeepers. However, there's lots of skepticism, both at home and abroad. The critics, are arguing that the U.S. concerns are really, this is really about tackling Islamic extremists, securing oil supplies, as well as countering Chinese influence in Africa. So that many Africans believe, in fact, that AFRICOM is really promoting American interests and not Africa's. Others argue that, again, that AFRICOM is just a growing trend. It's another the trend of militarization of American foreign policy. So, there are all questions that I hope that, we can discuss during this next hour concerning why AFRICOM and why now. Hmm.
Well, let's turn into Latin America for a moment, and I'll ask Professor Jacobson essentially to do the same thing. Professor Bowen started out by saying that the United States really has no coherent policy in Africa to replace the policy of the Cold War. I'm guessing one might say the same thing about Latin America.
I think she's dead right. As a matter of fact, I think for Latin America, one can say that at least in the first Bush administration, the policy that prevailed was a continuation of the Cold War policy. In the first moment of his presidency, that was before 9/11, 2001, Bush seemed to say that Latin America will be very central for my administration. He pointedly made his first foreign visit to Mexico, thereafter, everything fell apart. He gave all the positions in the government dealing with Latin America to the right wing of the Republican Party. People had come out of the Reagan administration, like Assistant Secretary for Hemispheric Affairs Otto Reich and so forth, sort of a very hardline sort of Cuban exile guy. And things followed from there. There is no new policy. In the second Bush administration, things have toned down somewhat. It is not as harsh anymore. It is not as confrontational, but there is no new policy. So what are the issues? The issues are sort of different for different parts of Latin America. There's no sort of overwhelming, all-encompassing strategy either. I think there are about three top issues. One issue is anti-drug trade, and that concerns the Andean countries and now increasingly also Mexico. The second is the policy on Cuba and sort of continuing a very, very hardline policy on Cuba that has affected us here at the University of Illinois by sort of making it impossible to continue our study abroad course in Cuba through the new policy of Bush in June of 2004. And thirdly, and this is a somewhat of a new element, I believe, sort of becoming worried about the leftward trend of increasingly more Latin American countries, a tilt in Latin American national politics, more and more reformers, populists have been elected to government in Latin America, and many of them have more or less strident positions against the United States. And so in connection with that, there's now also the challenge that these countries are increasingly diversifying their trade and political relationships. And here China has been looming very, very large. And so I think there's the beginning of a concern about Latin America as a sort of a source for resources, for primary resources, and trying to keep that under control. But basically, the Bush administration has followed in what one political scientist has called the hegemonic presumption, that is, the notion that Latin America is sort of the backwater of the United States. The United States can do there what it wants, and everybody else butt out. And that has been working less and less well.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting, you know, that here the United States has always considered Latin America to be important because, as you say, it's in it has always been considered to be within our sphere of influence. And that maybe Africa not – we didn't quite think of it in the same way. But it seems if you're looking for something that ties the two of these together, it's the it's a continuing preoccupation with American power and projecting that power and not – perhaps not so much in a partnership kind of way but in a more unilateral kind of way. True, you think? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do. I just want to, though, I gave the example of AFRICOM because it's one of the most controversial issues today, in Africa. But on the other hand, I think it's important to also note that President Bush's administration has had some success in terms of the HIV/AIDS policy. So on the one hand, yes, you do have AFRICOM and the militarization. Some people, some scholars would say militarization of American foreign policy. But, I would be I should say that, I think it's important as well to acknowledge the success of President Bush's administration when it comes to HIV/AIDS. President Clinton, who, the administration was actually missing in action when it came to AIDS in Africa. He became a much more effective campaigner after leaving office. Initially, President Bush had a USAID administrator who actually dismissed the antiretroviral treatment for Africans as impractical because, quote, he said Africans can't tell time. But yet now we find that the president's AIDS program is probably one of his most successful accomplishments he can claim for history. And so in October, and I think it was in mid-2008, he signed a new law which will reauthorize his previous law, which is referred to as the Presidential Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And initially, he was only going to give something like $30 billion over the next 5 years, which would have seriously underfunded the program. But now this new bill, with pressure from the U.S. as well as others abroad, means that the new bill comes with about $48 billion a year. So I think that this is something that we can celebrate. And I raise this only because I think, we need to have also a nuanced, view in terms of American policy in Africa.
I mean, if one wants to sort of find a connecting thing between Africa and Latin America, I think from the perspective of the peoples and also probably the elites and governments in both of those regions, the connective issue in terms of the United States is that the United States tends to treat these large regions as pawns, as sort of minor entities that are not really equal. It talks a good game about wanting to promote freedom and free trade, but whenever countries or popular movements in these areas propose things that do not fit into the very particular notion of freedom and free trade that the Bush administration has proposed, it is quite willing to use a whole panoply of tools to undercut the notions that are being promoted In Latin America or Africa. But I do think probably that in terms of Africa, there has been some more innovation that, than there has been in terms of Latin America. I mean, I think most political scientists today would say that the Bush administration policy towards Latin America has been the worst in many, many, many years, perhaps in history, towards Latin America. He doesn't have much to show in terms of success for Latin America. The thing that, from his perspective, were successes were some of the free trade agreements that have been signed. First, the one with Chile, I think that was 2002, then CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Association, and then just last year with Peru, the one with Colombia, which is perhaps the biggest deal, is blocked by the U.S. Congress for good reasons. So those are his quote-unquote successes that are very controversial successes. Yeah. But that's it. There's not much else that you can list.
We have a couple of callers. I'd like to bring them in. We have someone here who's calling from Terre Haute. So let's go there first. They're first in line on our toll-free line. Line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is Jim Turner calling from Terre Haute, Indiana.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've had the opportunity to travel to Africa in the last 3 years on medical missions, both to Morocco as well as Kenya. And when you go to Nairobi, you'll see that the largest public hospital was built by the Soviet Union as part of the Cold War buildup that both sides did. But what disturbs me is I'm seeing and reading a great deal about what China is doing in Africa now for their infrastructure. While the professor mentions we're sitting in military power, the Chinese are building roads, sewers, schools, water treatment plants, and taking a whole different approach to how they're helping Africans out. And as I understand it, even shifting their workforce when you have a population that survives on $2 a day, if they bring a factory and pays $4 a day, that's a great job for that community. And I understand even shifting their industries from China to even the cheaper sub-Saharan African labor. And just a comment then on what to think about China's approach more economically, building things that people can actually see and use, as opposed to us bringing in weapons and taking a military approach. I'd appreciate your comments.
Yeah, I thank you for the question. This is something I think that it's been written about and talked about quite a lot, the Chinese using what's come to be called soft power, doing things to build goodwill in Africa, and spending significant amounts of money doing some of the kinds of things that the caller talked about.
Right. I mean, I would agree that China has become a major international player in Africa through increasing levels of investment, especially in the extractive industries and numerous infrastructure projects. The Chinese have promised African leaders that they will double aid and scholarships for African students. China has promised, I think, close to $5 billion in cheap loans and credit, which could go either way. I mean, it's good to have that type of credit, but it could also backfire and worsen Africa's debt crisis and a repayment problem. So on the one hand, yes, you do have Africa coming in. I mean, not Africa, sorry, China coming in, repairing roads, building very needed infrastructure. So that's one part of Chinese policy. But on the other hand, we also know China has been very instrumental in the Sudan, for example. Sudan's biggest customer is China. And China was very influential in purchasing, you know, oil, which provided power for the Khartoum regime, kind of fueled repressive policies. So I think China offers a unique opportunity for Africa right now, because after the Cold War, of course, there was only kind of the West that African leaders could turn to. I think now it resembles a little bit, not, I don't want to say exactly what happened, what transpired during the Cold War, but it's an opportunity. African leaders have an opportunity that they didn't have, say, in the last two decades. And so we still have to, we have to see, what the outcome is going to be. But I think we have to take a nuanced kind of view again of Chinese policy in Africa.
Well, and I'm sure that there are people in Washington who, in looking at the growing presence of China in Africa and the growing influence, they're going to whatever models they've got to apply. They're going to apply the Cold War model. And if that's maybe not the best way to think about it, what would be a better way to think about it? It seems, you know, natural in Washington, they're going to think about, okay, well, what are America's interests? What should we be doing? And should we be worried about the increasing Chinese presence?
Well, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to just say one thing. I was thinking about Biden. Sorry, I had read something about his kind of, you know, approach to Chinese influence in Africa. And, you know, he said that, you know, the U.S. had put pressure actually on China to change its policy in terms of Khartoum, putting pressure on Khartoum to, you know, reduce kind of the violence, whatever, what was taking place in the Sudan and in Darfur. So we can also work with the Chinese. I don't think we necessarily have to be in opposition. It could end up that way. But it doesn't necessarily have to be. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that we have to see Chinese as, you know, the replacement of the USSR in Africa.
I think the policy of the United States in Latin America has to be to start again to re-earn Latin Americans' trust. It has largely lost that trust. And it cannot do that by bullying any government in terms of do not conclude contracts with China or something like that. That's impossible. That will not work. And particularly in the second term of the Bush administration, the influence of the United States in Latin America has declined precipitously. There's much more of an autonomy now, much more of fixing things that are happening internally, partly through the leadership of Brazil. So I think the United States has to compete with China. It has to see the benefits that Latin American countries derive from alternative markets for its goods. I mean, the boom, the tremendous boom that particularly in Argentina and Brazil has taken place over the past 5 years until just a couple of months ago. In terms of raw materials, soybeans, corn, also some minerals, has to do with Chinese demand. And, these countries, Argentina and Brazil, have seen tremendous economic growth rates during this time period because of the new demands from China. And to sort of say Latin America shouldn't do that is unrealistic.
Hmm. Well, I also just think that, you know, we have to also look at kind of the African perspective on this. We're in a situation here, as she said, economic crisis. It's clear that the U.S. and the West will not be forthcoming, given their own economic crisis and the amount of aid or trade that Africa needs. And so I think the real question is what Africans will do as the U.S. and Europe withdraw to perhaps just a few isolated interests on the continent. So I think, you know, we should look at how African policy evolves given the decline of U.S. power.
We are at a midpoint, and I hope that we responded to the question of the last caller. We have someone else. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Merle Bowen. She is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois and is very interested in the politics of Africa. Niels Jacobsen, he is Associate Professor of History, and he is interested in politics of Latin America. And that's what we're talking about here. Particularly what we're talking about is the interest of the United States, what American policy has been to this region, to these regions, perhaps how it should change. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And next we'll talk with someone in Urbana, line one.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather grudgingly admit that the Bush anti-HIV program is progressive. But particularly with the revisions that are fairly recent. However, it seems to me, at least, that the insistence on an abstinence portion to the program and the reluctance to promote the use of condoms rather substantially negates the value of the program.
Oh, I would agree with that. I mean, I was talking in terms of financial support, if you know, in terms of
I realize that.
antiretroviral drugs. But I think there are many debates that continue. There's the debate about the balance between treatment and prevention, between disease-specific programs and broader approaches to healthcare. I think these ongoing debates, in fact, indicate that the fight against AIDS is still only beginning. Worrisome, of course, is that, I shouldn't say in terms worrisome, but the support for the war against AIDS is now actually a bipartisan consensus, in terms of both the presidential candidates. But I think you're right. The ABC, which is termed as the ABC policy, is something that I think the Democrats, this is one way you can see the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, since most of the literature that I've been reading about the presidential candidates, they do have a different position, that they wouldn't be pushing as much the ABC policy as the Republican government has been doing, the Republican administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. Questions, comments, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You were, I think, Professor Jacobson, you were talking about the fact that people in Latin America, their opinion of the United States is not particularly high. Certainly their opinion of the president is not particularly high. I was interested to read the results of a survey, and I'm not sure about the orientation of the group that conducted it, so that might influence the results. But the thing that struck me was that, yes, it's true that George Bush is quite unpopular among Latin Americans, but they also apparently aren't all that excited about Hugo Chavez or Fidel Castro either. I mean, it's not like people like that necessarily have a leg up. You know, they it sounds as if people would maybe be interested in steering sort of a middle course between those two kinds of extremes.
Well, in part that's correct. I think that Hugo Chavez meddling in politics in other Latin American countries has, in fact, turned elections around. That was the case in Peru in 2006. Alan Garcia won because Hugo Chavez supported Alan Garcia's opposition candidate. And there's also something to be said that López Obrador in Mexico lost because of Chavez's support for him. Mm-hmm. So that is true. But when the United States pushes on Cuba, on Venezuela, then Latin America, all the other Latin American countries, and the great majority of Latin Americans will stand behind them. Latin American countries have had long experiences with authoritarian governments and with different types of populism from the right and from the left, and they're very skeptical. I think you're right. There's tremendous skepticism among Latin Americans about government. Strangely enough, although we always think of Latin American governments as so authoritarian, so the people really are very skeptical. And so, yes, there is that kind of skepticism, although one also should say that Chavez himself was reelected with a majority, and other left-wing populists as well. I mean, Morales had the largest majority in recent presidential elections in Bolivia, and Correa did too, and so forth. So there is a lot of support for that style of politics and policies, but you're right, there's also skepticism. Mm-hmm.
Just one other quick point, and I'm going to get back here to somebody on the phone. I think some people would suggest that one of the things we really need to reexamine, and you mentioned it, was our policy toward Cuba. Mm-hmm. And I think there are people who would argue that it just doesn't make sense, and it hasn't made sense for a while, and that we ought to be doing what we can to move towards more normal kind of relations. What do you think the possibility within the next 5-10 years would be for actually doing that, for opening things up at least?
Well, under McCain, it would be zero for the next 4 years because McCain has clearly declared that he is not going to tinker with the embargo. He's very much made clear that he wants to continue that, and also travel restriction. I mean, there McCain really would be a clear continuation of Bush policies. Obama is a little bit less clear. It's mm-hmm. a bit more open. I mean, he says he's ready to talk with the Cuban administration. He has said he will not abandon the embargo unconditionally. He wants to use the embargo as a chip to open things in Cuba. But he has said that in terms of travel policies, he wants loosening of restrictions. For example, Bush has made it so hard that even family travel can only be once every 3 years. Before it was once every year. And as you know, he also totally cut out many study abroad trips in 2004. So I think Obama would be somewhat more open, but it's not clear what. In some ways, I suspect that at a certain point, these U.S. debates will become irrelevant because, I mean, there is ongoing change in Cuba. And, I mean, lots of other countries are establishing commercial relationships with Cuba and investing and so forth. And this will happen. I mean, Cuba has basically adopted the Chinese road, I mean, to try to keep an authoritarian control over its people, but at the same time developing a sort of a market economy. And so change will happen whether the United States wants to be part of it or not. I mean, it would be a lot better for Cuba if the United States broke the embargo. And I think it would be a lot better for a lot of U.S. companies. The U.S. companies are hollering for this. And, mm-hmm. and as a matter of fact, in Congress, in the House of Representatives, there have been repeated votes to do away with the embargo, which have been vetoed by Bush.
Let's take another caller here. Morris, line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I kind of disagree with some of this stuff. I think United States, I'd be left out of any doings. I think it's up to them. We're in a modern times now. If they can't handle it, or, you know, that the people of that country can't produce somebody worthwhile, and, you know, I don't understand. We're having problems with our own elections here in the United States. I mean, it's a serious problem when more than half the people don't vote. We should not be dictating to the rest of the world when our American public doesn't understand the seriousness of this. And I would like your comment on this.
Okay. Well, I would think that at least you would agree with the last statement of the caller that you're not arguing for the United States to be dictating to the rest of the world. I think so. The question would be, in what way, you know, what sort of relationship does the United States have with these countries? Should the United States be involved in those countries at all? And if the question is, well, yes, in what way? And so that seems to be the question. Perhaps the question is can the United States be involved in a way that is cooperative and that is that has some benefit to the people of those countries and not just some benefit to the United States? Is that too much to hope that such a you could imagine such a policy?
Well, let me just say I'm not sure that I would agree with. I thought that the caller was talking about kind of a dichotomy, kind of policy in the sense that, you know, we've got to focus just on internal domestic politics and ignore foreign policy, and I would have to oppose that. I mean, clearly, you know, we have a lot of problems in the U.S. and we have to, you know, deal with those problems. But that doesn't mean that we should ignore foreign policy and we should have a coherent policy in Africa, in Latin America, and elsewhere. So I think that, you know, we should address both of these issues, the foreign policy as well as domestic policy. I think in terms of the central issues for improving relations with Africa, U.S. policy in Africa, is that we have to think about, you know, the diversity of African countries and U.S. interest. I don't think there are going to be any magical formulas, but there should be some principles that should apply. And I can think of a number of principles. I think one of them, which Niels has alluded to, is just, you know, we should open up a genuine dialogue about trade and development policy instead of imposing these very rigid free market policies that are very biased in terms of rich countries. I think we can minimize bilateral military involvement in Africa, because what this does, it risks U.S. intervention in local conflicts. And so we should probably favor more multilateral diplomacy, peacekeeping, as well as peacekeeping. I think we could stop aiding, for example, repressive regimes and start supporting some of the democratic solutions. And this took place, for example, in the aftermath of the Kenyan election. That crisis could have erupted in a civil war, but instead, you know, there was mediation by the former UN Secretary Kofi Annan, and the U.S. played a very supportive role. I mean, we could see more of that. One of the examples about relying on African diplomats. So there have been these, you know, distinguished former presidents that have intervened in different conflicts, President Mandela in Burundi, for example. Thabo Mbeki's maybe is more questionable about his mediation in Zimbabwe. But the fact is that there's no initiative is going to be successful unless African civil society and political leaders are in the forefront. I think the U.S. and finally, I think that, you know, we could support the large community of recent African immigrants to the U.S. And many of them are engaged in family and community projects to help their own countries.
Yeah, I think Merle is absolutely correct. I understood the caller to sort of say that the United States should not dictate in terms of elections. And I agree with him on that point. I mean, I would not support isolationism. Clearly, the United States has to be engaged. It will be engaged because of its own self-interests. But he's right that the United States has dictated a lot in terms of elections, also in terms of economic policies in Latin America and other parts of the world. And that is not going to go very well anymore. As a matter of fact, Latin Americans are very good on satirizing the United States. For example, they said, okay, after the 2000 election and the debacle in Florida, they said, so you're lecturing us on democratic elections and what's going on in your elections? And now, in the past months or so, they said, so you're lecturing us on free trade and sort of strict separation of the state and the economy. And now look what you're saying. You blame us for socialism, dirigism or whatever, and look, you're buying up banks. And so they catch the irony and the satire. So the United States is not viewed at this moment as a great exemplar for people in Latin America. The thing that the United States has to start with is the respect and bilateral negotiations that do not push sort of in a very hard way. I mean, the United States still has obviously a lot more power resources than any Latin American country, and if it wants to, it can push a lot of things on Latin America. But that will only alienate them further. And so it needs to listen. It needs to see what is in the interest of the Latin American countries. It needs to sort of see that there are vast cultural differences, that free trade or what adopting democracy means is going to be very, very different for different kinds of interests and mm-hmm. different kinds of cultures.
Did you want to add something?
I just wanted to add just one point to, mm-hmm. to Nils. I think that if the U.S., you know, takes a very narrow view of Africa, that is, sees Africa as a recipient of charity, a place to pump oil, an arena for just fighting terrorists, then I think African hopes are certainly going to be disappointed. Yeah. If, however, though, the U.S. takes a longer view, and that is understanding that its security depends on the human security in Africa, then I think there are real prospects for a new era of collaboration and goodwill.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with some other callers. Champaign County is our next person here, line number one. Hello.
I appreciate the last line about Latin America and the lampooning that's possible. Professor Bowen said that maybe free markets are working all right in the developed countries, but that's an arguable point, too. I can't let the remark about Obrador losing many Mexicans don't believe he lost, just as the previous fraudulent election that I believe kept Calderon. Is that the right
yes.
gentleman? Mm-hmm. So, we can't be lecturing, but the Mexicans. I think we may have consultants working on each other's elections as far as how to commit fraud, I'm afraid. I actually had a question about Africa. That's what prompted me to call. I hear a lot of people saying that, well, if Bush has any legacy, it's his policy towards raising various monies, mostly aid money to Africa, and I think it's a total fraud there too, actually, because the Millennium Development process was just dead in the waters for several years. All they had to accomplish was building a fancy new building to rival the World Bank building in D.C. and not much else. Now they have a few outreach and trade, not aid, sort of mantras going on. But even on the AIDS front, we hear about the increase in aid. Most of the time, you have to read the fine print to see that they've added up all the cumulative totals that they've put in earlier that hadn't been paid. And then you have the policy of subservience to Big Pharma. I mean, I still remember real clearly that Cheney, in I believe it was 2005, just came in and totally tore up a internationally developed protocol that would have allowed for AIDS drugs to go in to Africa sooner, generics basically. And the U.S. had been negotiating all along, and just threw up the table, and they had to start from scratch. And it seems to me that if you total in the amount of delaying that was going on in that, you have to tote up a rather large death toll, to mince words, on subservience to Big Pharma. So I have to go, so I will let the chips fall where they may. Thank you.
All right. Well, Professor Bowen?
Well, I just want to emphasize that when I was talking about principles, I actually said that what the United States should do is actually open a genuine dialogue about trade and development policy instead of imposing rigid free market policies that are very biased in favor of the rich countries. I wasn't promoting free market policies in Africa. I got a little bit confused with the last caller because I thought he was talking about aid in Africa, and then he seems to then switch a little bit to the policies of HIV.
Well, I think I thought he was talking about aid that was directed at that, trying to help with that issue, the money we have spent trying to help fighting HIV and AIDS.
Right. Well, all I can say is what I've said before. I mean, we've increased it from Bush's first administration term and to his second. And I think the increase, you know, has been met with euphoria, actually, both on this side and the other side of the, and abroad. I was going to talk, though, a little bit about aid, not HIV AIDS, but I did want to say something about that as well, because aid from the world's developing countries have actually fallen dramatically by almost 13% from 2005 to 2007. Now, the aid budget of most developed nations amounts to about 0.2% of their gross national product. And there are very few countries that have actually met this target, the Nordic countries, like usual, and I think Canada as well. But many of the countries have, you know, strings attached to their aid. And even though the Group 8 of industrialized nations pledged in 2005 to donate more than $25 billion to Africa by 2010, only $4 billion so far has been provided by 2008. So I know it's a little bit different than what the caller was saying, but I also was thinking about that when he was
And I think that's probably a good point, because it's something that I think people frequently here in the United States, they complain about the amount of money that the United States spends on foreign aid, not just for Africa, but for any of it. And that, in fact, if you look at the budget of the U.S. government, the amount of money that we're spending on foreign aid is really quite small. It's very small. And certainly compared to other countries that are not as wealthy as the United States, you know, they spend as a proportion of, you know, in terms of how much money they have to spend, they're spending a lot more than we are. So it's really quite small.
Right. The United States is actually at the bottom of the list. It spends about 0.16% of income on development assistance. So it is quite low compared to, as you said, other countries.
Yeah, in Latin America also, aid from the United States has declined, with one exception, and that is Colombia. Plan Colombia, since Clinton initiated it in 2000 until today, has spent something like $6 billion presumably for drug interdiction, sort of helping the Colombian military to sort of go after the drug traffickers and eradication programs for coca fields. But many people suspect, and in fact it's pretty clear, that it was also directed to help the Uribe government, that hasn't been in power since 2002, with the fight against the guerrillas, the FARC. And this is very, very controversial because the Uribe government has many, many human rights abuses against it, and that's why the U.S. Congress has not been willing to ratify the free trade agreement with Colombia.
Would it be correct to say that if you ask this question of the governments in Latin America, who is it that in a formal sense we consider our friends and where we have put in a lot of resources, that in fact Colombia is number one?
Yes. And, I mean, in fact, there aren't very many friends
left. Well, that's another point as well to be
Uribe
made.
Uribe is clearly the key figure here. Calderón in Mexico is very friendly towards the United States, and Alan García in Peru. That's the short list.
Yeah. All right. We're trying to get a couple of callers more here. And next, I think we'll talk with somebody in Champaign, I believe, line two. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
My comments are directed toward Dr. Jacobson. And I want to say first just two brief comments. One, I agree with much of what Dr. Jacobson is mentioning regarding the U.S.'s policy toward Latin America in the past 7 years. It has been very much a captive of Cold War history and very myopic to the current mood in Latin America. But I should mention my own background is as a former U.S. diplomat to Latin America, most recently at the U.S. mission to the Organization of American States. And from that perspective, while I agree with much of what he has said, I would like to throw on the table the idea that there needs to be more of a distinction made between no policy toward Latin America versus failed policies. Because from my perspective, being part of that, I would say there was a fairly consistent policy. Perhaps it was not backed up sufficiently with money and it wasn't high level, but very much a continuation of Cold War liberalism. And in particular, I would highlight September 11th, 2001, in addition to attacks by terrorists, there was also the passage of the Inter-American Democratic Charter. And that really, I believe, has formed a cornerstone of U.S. policy, this idea very specific of representative democracy in contrast to other versions of democracy, and also this notion of good governance, which has been sort of a consistent thread throughout U.S. policy in the past 7 years. So I would conclude with that. I think there is a difference there. There has been a policy. I just think it has largely fallen on an unfriendly population at this point because it has not really adapted to the current changes in Latin American society. So with that, I'm going to take off the phone here and listen on air.
Thank you for the comment. You respond?
I thank the caller. I did not say that there was no policy. I said there was no coherent policy and no adaptation, no new policy. I do think, as you seem to agree, that it is in large part a continuation of the Cold War policy. Now, you called it Cold War liberalism pushing representative democracy. Yes, that is, in terms of the rhetoric, one of the key goals of U.S. policy in Latin America. However, if you look how they are pursuing it and how they are representing it, that's where it becomes troublesome. The United States has intervened in numerous election campaigns over the past 8 years in Latin America, spending massive amounts of money, massive for Latin American relations, $30, $40, $50 million in terms of supporting opposition movements whenever the United States thought that the current government was not friendly enough. So this has been going on in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Bolivia, of course Venezuela. There are credible stories that suggest that the April 2002 coup against Chavez was heavily supported with funding from the United States. So, yes, representative democracy is a wonderful goal, and clearly that has to happen. But the way the United States has interpreted that and what they felt they had to do was off, was very strange. Hmm.
Well, I'm at the point here where I'm sorry to say that we're going to have to stop because we've used the time. These are two very big subjects, and obviously we could have divided them into a little bit smaller pieces and talked more about the individual pieces, and perhaps we should say that's what we would try to do on future programs and talk a little bit more. But I appreciate both of you being here and giving us some overview. Our guest this morning, Niels Jacobsen, he is Associate Professor of History at the U of I. Merle Bowen, she is Associate Professor of Political Science. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.